Parks and Belgium.
Yes, please, yes. Please do that. That would be good. Thank you. We're ready, sir.
May I please the court? I'm Tom Phillips. I'm a lawyer from Rustburg, Virginia. Clifford Riley Duke, Jr., who I probably will call Riley from time to time.
Can you speak up a little bit? I'm having trouble.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'll project my voice. Please let me know if I need to be loud. Mr. Dugan was stopped by an officer in Amherst County because the officer believed the tires on the Toyota pickup truck extended too far beyond the body. After making that observation, he observed Mr. Dugan to be the driver. He knew Dugan. He followed Dugan and called in his information and confirmed that Mr. Dugan did not have a driver's license. So there is no question about the basis of the stop. The officer did these things right.
It really comes down to whether he was aware of the nature and character of the controlled substance that was found in the gear shift area?
Not even nature and character, Your Honor, because he had prior convictions involving this drug. What it comes down to is whether he was aware that it was present in that area, in this case. If it had been in plain view, as was, of course, the case with Mr. White, the driver of Mr. Calwood's car, then we wouldn't be here, because there would be no questions.
But here, he's the driver of the car. He's not the owner of the car, but he's the driver of the car.
No question.
There's some evidence that he's the usual driver of the car, although his mother, I guess, is the titled owner of the vehicle.
I think the only evidence about who is driving the car is that it had been purchased for him, but that as far as his mother knew, this was the first time he had driven it. He told the officer who stopped him, he admitted he didn't have a license, and he said, the only reason I'm driving is because I have to get to work. My ride didn't show up. So there's not evidence that this has been in his possession a long time. The evidence is that his mother had actually purchased it within
But I think the evidence, I guess maybe I misspoke, but I thought the evidence was that the circuit court found that your client was the only driver of the vehicle during the time that his mother owned it.
I don't remember him making that finding, Your Honor. He did find that he was the sole occupant of the vehicle, and everything in it was subject to his dominion and control on the day of the stop.
Well, and of course, the drugs are found under a towel that's wrapped around the gear shift lever.
There's no question, a towel that is in place of the normal boot, which right. normally is there to keep trash.
I'm old enough to remember what a stick shift looks like. So.
Yes, to keep trash from falling down through there and to keep heat from coming back out. There is no evidence how long the towel has been there. There certainly is no evidence who had put the towel there. The only evidence we have is the evidence from Investigator Bagley that you could not see the substance that he discovered until after he removed the towel.
Oh, that's what I was leading up to. It's certainly not normal for a towel to be wrapped around the gear shift lever in lieu of the boot. It certainly attracted the officer's suspicion because the first thing he did was unwrap the towel to see what was going on with this thing, and the drugs were found right underneath there, and I guess in a little void area that the towel had covered up. It seems to me it comes down to whether or not that evidence is sufficient given the totality of the circumstances to show that he likely was aware it was there. I mean, I know his assertion is that it belonged to maybe the previous owner, but drugs cost money, and most people don't leave their drugs just lying around. The evidence came in apparently unobjected to that he was in the drug trade in one capacity or another. And
the reason the evidence came in unobjected to, Your Honor, was of course the investigating officer initially charged him with possession with the intent to distribute, second, third, or subsequent offense, so it was part of the Commonwealth's proof.
Well, so my point is simply that evidence is before the fact finder, and it's part of the totality of the circumstances. So I'm trying to understand how the only way it seems to me to get to where you want us to go is to assert that somehow the fact finder necessarily should have had to believe your client's version of all of this.
No, sir. That's not what I'm arguing. What I'm arguing is that this court got it exactly right in Kelly versus Commonwealth when you said that in addition to in the vehicle, ownership or occupancy of the vehicle creates no presumption of knowledge, that the Commonwealth must point to evidence of acts, statements, or conduct of the accused. There's none of that in this case because he pulled over promptly, got out of the car, he immediately gave the officer permission to search his person and the vehicle. He didn't make any statements admitting that he knew it was there. In fact, he denied it. Even if the court is not required to believe that, then the court's left with absolutely no evidence on that issue.
Other than proximity.
Proximity is the only issue that we have in this case. And the value of the drugs. The Commonwealth says, well, it's...
Well, yeah, proximity and sole occupancy.
Yes, but again, we have...
Neither of those by themselves are enough, but together that obviously... You know, the question is how many of these things that standing alone aren't enough when put together are enough.
I agree with that, Your Honor. And in fact, the trial judge thought that Calward wasn't really a binding precedent in this case because he said that doesn't count. There were two people in that vehicle. And of course, this court affirmed the conviction of the driver, but I would respectfully point out that in affirming that conviction, one of the things this court pointed to is that the cocaine in that case was in plain view on the console. The difference between this case and the White case, the unreported decision involving Cowell's driver, is that it was visible to someone. How, without speculating, is it possible to say when those drugs got under the towel, who put the towel there, and if Mr. Dugan knew that anything was under the towel?
Could a reasonable fact finder conclude that the drugs, given where they were on this narrow ledge, hadn't been there very long?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because the towel was stuffed down around it. There's nothing to indicate that there's such a slope there that these drugs would have fallen out of the way. The only evidence is that they were completely concealed under a towel. The officer didn't see them until he removed the towel, and that Mr. Dugan made no admission of any kind about knowing they were there. In fact, he denied it. The evidence in this case is that the truck had been purchased for him, but it had only been purchased a short time before. It had been in a shop being worked on until a matter of several days before.
Most cars I've been involved in purchasing don't come with a supply of methamphetamine as a extra dealer incentive, if you will. We said in Irvin and some other cases that's also a factor that could be considered, is that people don't lightly abandon drugs that are, you know, that are valuable.
Yes, sir. I respectfully point out you said the same thing in Maxwell when all of the drugs were discovered in the stacks of lumber in the wood yard, and the Supreme Court reversed that, finding that was not a sufficient circumstance, even though acknowledging that perhaps it is unusual for people to leave valuable property. In this case, we have a situation where there are much fewer. The quantity of drugs is much lower than in Maxwell. There are no suspicious circumstances like running from the police and coming back later, like were present in Maxwell. All we have is a man who stopped driving a vehicle when an item is moved, and I would submit it would be the same thing if, rather than being wrapped around the shifter, if the towel had been laying in the floorboard. Unless there's some admission or some furtive movement showing that he's aware of it, or even looking at it repeatedly while the officer is talking to him. There's no
to
way
me,
to know.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, he's the sole occupant of the vehicle. It's been recently purchased. The drugs are found certainly in close proximity to where he is. Although, as you correctly point out, that's not enough standing alone. The drug in question is methamphetamine. The evidence is he's a methamphetamine dealer in the past. The fact we've already talked about that reasonable, it's reasonable to conclude that one does not lightly abandon controlled substances. That you put all that together, tell us why it's not enough as a matter of law.
Well, the first thing, Your Honor, is of course this court and the Supreme Court have both held that even if you can get into evidence prior involvement with a controlled substance because you have to prove an enhanced level of offense. The prior convictions are not in and of themselves evidence that you are knowingly and intentionally in possession of the drug on this occasion. It falls, it's a modification.
It's certainly true, just because you've been guilty of crimes in the past, you're not, doesn't make you guilty of this crime. But it's a factor. I mean, clearly it's a factor that can be considered.
And I can see that what it does do is it eliminates the necessity of proving that he would know what amphetamine was. That's not an issue in this case. The only issue is if it's completely invisible and there's no evidence how long he's been in there or that he's done anything to disturb the covering, is there any way that you can, consistent with Klodfelter versus Commonwealth, that old case from 1977, is there any way you can say that the proof relied upon by the Commonwealth is not only consistent with guilt, but inconsistent with innocence? What is required for him to be found not guilty is for the evidence to be consistent with him not being aware that the drug was under the towel, where it was hidden. I would respectfully submit that in arguing the case, the assistant commonwealth's attorney tacitly acknowledged that on page 60 of the appendix when her argument was, Your Honor, the Commonwealth would submit that it is consistent with guilt. Well, it's not enough that the evidence is consistent with guilt. It has to be inconsistent with innocence. And the Klodfelter court went on to say, circumstances of suspicion, no matter how grave or strong, are not sufficient to support a verdict of guilty. Remember, in Klodfelter, not only did he give a false name and deny that he was the only occupant of the room, and their drugs were left in the room, but the court said that that wasn't enough without some of the proof that he was aware the drugs were there. We don't have false identification. We don't have attempts to flee. We don't have any effort to conceal or move the property. We have a situation where the guy says, sure, you can search me, you can search the vehicle, and when the officer does, he discovers this contraband. I respectfully submit that although that may be consistent with guilt, there is no evidence from which the court could find, without speculating, that he knew that substance was there. And although it is unusual, perhaps, for people to abandon items of value, if we accept that as a rule in all drug cases, then the exception has eaten the rule. If you say that, if you're the only occupant of a vehicle and drugs are found, then how is that different than there being a presumption that you know the drugs are there? It is a backdoor way to put the burden of proof on the defendant. I would respectfully submit that that's what the trial court did in this case, and would respectfully ask this court to reverse the decision, finding that it was insufficient to prove he knew the material was present in the vehicle. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Uberman.
Please support David Uberman on behalf of the Commonwealth. As the court has appropriately already noted, the question in this appeal is essentially, is Mr. Dugan aware of the presence of the methamphetamine? And in this case, the evidence demonstrates that he was. Now, in support of his argument to the contrary, Mr. Dugan relies primarily, if not entirely, upon this court's prior decision in Cowan versus Commonwealth. But that case, I think, is distinguishable despite Mr. Dugan's argument to the contrary. There, Mr. Coward was a passenger in the car, and I know it's late in the day, so I won't belabor the court with the facts of that case beyond that, which
there
is
was nothing in that case but proximity. That's all.
Correct,
that's all the Commonwealth relied on.
It was dark when the car was pulled over, and Mr. Coward said nothing. He didn't make any furtive movements. And as the court knows, the driver in that case, Tyrese White, did not fare as well as Mr. Coward on appeal. And what this court noted in the published opinion of Coward was that, you know, his appeal was rejected, and that, like Mr. Dugan, Mr. White, the driver, did not make furtive movements. He did not make any statements. And I think it's interesting to look at the way this court handled that presence element in those two cases. In Coward, of course, it was nighttime, and applied to the passenger, the court noted that the officer or the crack cocaine in that case was on the console. It was small, and this court noted that it was only visible when the officer shined his flashlight on it. in, again, it's unpublished, but in White, which is appended to the Commonwealth's brief, what this court said there. And White did admit, he said the car was not his, but he admitted to driving it that entire evening. And there the court said that it was in plain sight. And I think that is a tacit recognition that this is not a case where we're dealing with mere proximity, as this court's cases have used. We also have sole occupancy in this case, and the occupancy involved is what changes that calculus with respect to the presence. It's unreasonable to assume that the driver of the car, who is admitted to driving that entire evening, is unaware of that contraband sitting there. And I certainly understand Mr. Phillips' point that, well, hey, the difference here is that it was not in plain sight. It was hidden underneath this towel. And that goes to this reasonable, or I would say unreasonable hypothesis of innocence, because what that requires the court to believe is that Mr. Dugan, or Mr. Saunders, rather, who was the prior owner of the truck, who again, it was hearsay, but it was not objected to, so Investigator Bailey testified that he was involved in the cocaine trade. So the argument that Mr. Dugan wants this court to believe is that somehow Mr. Saunders, who's involved with the cocaine trade, left approximately $120 worth of methamphetamine inside a truck for approximately 2 months and never realized, hey, you know, again, it's valuable, I want my property back. It also requires us to believe that, and I think this is significant, is that not once did Mr. Dugan think to look under the towel, and it's on page 79 of the appendix, and I don't want to belabor the point, but it is extremely conspicuous. There is a reason that when Investigator Bagley testified at trial, he said it's the very first thing he noticed, and in exchange with the prosecutor, it became clear that the very first thing he noticed upon moving it was the methamphetamine, which it's difficult a little bit to follow the conversation because, you know, they're saying, was it there, was it on the lip, but what was clear was that it was immediately apparent as soon as that towel was moved. Mr. Dugan's theory of innocence would also require this court to believe that his friend Moore, who testified that he had the truck for about 2 months prior to Mr. Dugan's or his mother's purchase on behalf of Mr. Dugan, that he never once disturbed that towel. And I say that's relevant because at the time, counsel expressly asked Mr. Moore whether he had moved the towel. So I'm assuming that there's an attempt to try and chain this all the way back to Mr. Saunders. Fourth, it would also require that the testimonies the court may recall is that Judy Dugan, Mr. Dugan's mother, testified that she purchased the car. She waffled a little bit on whether it was for Mr. Dugan, but Mr. Dugan conceded to the investigator that the car was purchased for him. Judy Dugan testified that the car was in the truck was in the shop for approximately 2 weeks. It would also require us to infer that this towel was not disturbed in the process of having whatever work that was done on it for a period of 2 weeks at the local garage. And she said that the truck had been returned to their residence, which she described in the country, for about 2 or 3 days. She said they lived in the country, they kept the car, or they kept the keys and all the drugs. Mr. Dugan certainly had access to that. He was the only person of driving age that would not have had a vehicle at that house but for that truck. So I think it is reasonable to assume that he had access to it. But even irrespective of all of that, we know for a fact that he had access to it on the day that he was pulled over. And under this court's case law, that's sufficient to establish that sole proximity or sole occupancy in addition to proximity. The Commonwealth is not required to prove that someone else abandoned the contraband, planted or discarded it when it's going on a theory of constructive possession. Judge Humphreys, as you mentioned earlier, it's essentially, without using the term of art, it's a totality of the circumstances test. And in this case, you know, Dugan attempts to color his compliance with investigators' Bagley request to pull over, you know, his act of pulling over, now he immediately says, or perhaps immediately is too harsh a word, but at some point he, without solicitation, says, I ain't got nothing illegal in the car, you can search it. And at least brief, the argument is made, well, why would he say that unless he wanted to allow the officer to search the car? And I don't mean to be colloquial, but, and it's certainly not precedent on this court, but anyone who's seen cops knows that people consent to searches where they have contraband all the time. And there's a string citation in the brief that specifically list this court's some recent opinions over the last 5-6 years where defendants have consented to a search that is later discovered contraband. So I don't think,
you acknowledge that proximity alone is not sufficient.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Sole occupancy alone is not sufficient.
Correct, Your Honor.
But your position here is that the two of them together are sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would add to that that it's that totality, and in this case we happen to have those two things, but in addition to that we have this aspect that the drug is hidden, and I think is it reasonable to infer that Mr. Dugan hid the drugs? We have testimony.
It seems like a circuitous kind of argument, though. That doesn't say anything about who hid the drug there.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. Perhaps I should couch it as. Instead, it's reason to reject the reasonable hypothesis of innocence that Mr. Dugan has put forward for those reasons that I listed before, the value of the drugs, the fact that Mr. Saunders was not involved with the methamphetamine.
Well, is there a particular case that you rely on for the proposition that while proximity alone or sole occupancy alone is not enough, combining the two of them suddenly makes it sufficient?
No, Your Honor. I, other than this court's precedent that circumstantial evidence is not viewed in isolation, and that, as I think the court very eloquently said in Emerson, that while no single piece of evidence may be sufficient in and of itself, that taken together, that evidence may irresistibly lead a mind to a certain conclusion. And in this case, I think it's reasonable under the circumstances to conclude that Mr. Dugan was aware of the drugs in this case. Again, the pickup truck was purchased for his use. He had access to the keys. He was a known distributor of methamphetamine. And I do want to distinguish separate, you know, Mr. Phillips did object at the beginning of trial to the admission of that prior conviction. Because again, the issue there was that there was subsequent distribution. As we know, the Commonwealth failed to meet its burden with distribution. And that was a continuing objection with respect to the use of that for any other purpose other than just establishing the subsequent offense. But there is a distinction between what the unobjected to hearsay testimony of Investor Bagley when he says that Mr. Dugan was involved in the methamphetamine trade. That is different, and the natural probative value of that is that this person is not familiar with methamphetamine, but again, what are the chances that he doesn't move the towel? He just happens to be involved in the methamphetamine trade. He has access to the truck. He's the sole occupant during the search.
I'm trying to understand the photographs I think it's page 78, show a shifter, what appears to be a shifter lever with a boot around it.
Correct, Your Honor.
The next photograph shows a different shift lever.
If it helps for clarification, Your Honor,
please.
Investor Bagley testified that, again, Defendant's Exhibit C, which is on page 79, that's what it looked like when he approached it. He may have said it was tamped down a little more. I want to give Mr. Dugan credit there, but that I'm not exactly sure why Exhibit B was introduced other than perhaps to show this is what it looks like without it, but I can say with certainty that it's the exhibit on page 79 with that towel. That's what Investor Bagley saw when he pulled over Mr. Dugan. And again, I think it speaks volumes that the very first thing he did was search there, that this was apparent to him. Taken together, I think those circumstances demonstrate that Mr. Dugan must have been aware of the presence.
When they were looking at that exhibit during the trial, it seems from reading that they were up there pointing and illustrating their testimony with pointing where and the ledge and all this kind of stuff and maybe how it was tucked in, but there was some use of that exhibit more than would show just from the picture itself. There was some kind of demonstrative illustration of exactly where things were in each relation.
Yes,
Your Honor.
That's correct, and that there's a reason that the Commonwealth chose to reproduce that section of the transcript on its brief, and it's on pages 3 and 4, and that's because I didn't feel comfortable, quite frankly, summarizing what occurred there, because there was a lot of pointing to this, that saying the lip. So I simply wanted to reproduce to the court the relevant section and say, you know, obviously we lack the perspective that the judge would have had, but the judge certainly didn't lack that perspective at the time of the trial. But it seemed clear. I think the judge may have even interjected with a question at one point on page 29 to 30 of the appendix. And, yeah, so the question the prosecutor asked, can the court see what he's pointing at? Yes. So again, I know that's not the most reliable thing for me to stand on here, but I don't think that's all I have to stand on, other than to say that the court was certainly aware of exactly what Mr. or Investigator Bagley was referring to when he was referring to it on the stand. Given those circumstances, I think it's fair to argue in this case that Dugan simply can't demonstrate that no rational trier of fact could have found the evidence sufficient to support his conviction. And unless there are any additional questions, I respectfully ask the court for the Amherst County Circuit Court.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Phillips, your rebuttal.
If Your Honor, please. The one thing I would do is clarify the issue of court raised about
Thank you.
Exhibits, if I could. Although it's referred to as the shifter boot, actually this has an automatic transmission shifter that had the boot in place. Then it has a separate shifter to put it in four-wheel drive, two-wheel drive, four-wheel high, four-wheel low. That was the one that lacked the boot. And if you look at Exhibit C, you actually see top of it, you see the squared portion of the boot around the automatic transmission shifter.
Thank you.
And you see the towel around the four-wheel drive.
And the evidence included that the towel had been there continuously for the time that the vehicle had been purchased by defendant's mother.
Your Honor, defendant did not testify in this case. The evidence, certainly from his friend, was it had been there earlier. I can't recall whether his mother said she noticed it there or not, but certainly there was no evidence that it had been placed in the vehicle after it had been acquired by the defendant's mother or by the defendant. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll come down, greet counsel, and then take up the last case of the docket, the Bortzer case.